Ready for our second case, which is Morales case. Mr. Sauer.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Edmund Sauer. I represent the petitioner appellant Angel Morales in this case. On appeal today is the appeal from the denial of Mr. Morales' first and only request for post-conviction relief, in which he establishes that under existing Seventh Circuit law, he is innocent of the crime of his conviction and incarceration. What happened here is Mr. Morales filed a Section 2255 motion with the court of his conviction and sentencing, the Northern District of Indiana, and in that motion requested that court to grant him relief under 2255. And if relief were unavailable under 2255, he asked that court to transfer his request for post-conviction relief to the Southern District of Indiana, which is the court and the jurisdiction of his incarceration, for consideration under Section 2241.
What if he'd been incarcerated in, say, Michigan, or transferred from the prison camp in Terre Haute to Michigan? How would that affect his innocence?
Well, it would depend on what the Sixth Circuit established of the
law
there.
Assuming the Sixth Circuit is contrary to our...
That's right. If there is a inter-circuit transfer, that is certainly not sufficient to establish someone's innocence. For instance, if he were in a circuit where he was tried, convicted, justly incarcerated, and then transferred to the Sixth Circuit, where the Sixth Circuit says, we adopt a different interpretation, that is not enough to render his sentence unlawful. But that's not the case we have here, right? He was convicted, sentenced, and incarcerated in the same circuit, in this circuit. And under this circuit's law, he's innocent.
I'd like to turn back to the jurisdiction issue, you know, that we've got to wrestle with here. Other than the verbal assurances by Mr. Kinney that the petition had been filed, is there any indication that Mr. Kinney provided any such assurances in writing or provided false updates regarding the progress of the petition in writing?
Your Honor, that is precisely why we need an evidentiary hearing on this issue. He expressly alleges on pages 120 to 121 of the separate appendix that his attorney, whom he hired and retained within the one-year period, expressly told him and his daughter repeatedly that he had filed the 2255 motion and even concocted status reports and told them. We don't have evidence on this issue because the Northern District, sua sponte, raised the statute of limitations, didn't give us a hearing, didn't give us an opportunity to explain why this filing was timely.
Have there been disciplinary proceedings instituted with regard to Mr. Kinney?
He retired soon after this case was filed under threat of disbarment from the Indiana Bar Association.
Is there a record of that?
Not here. Again, we would...
Well, I mean, is there a record within the proceedings before the Indiana Supreme Court or the disciplinary commission?
Yes, sir, and those are cited in our brief, and I will provide in my rebuttal citations to those for Your Honor.
I don't understand your failure to appeal from the denial of the 2255.
Okay. The 2255, there was one motion that was filed, and it was unusual in the sense it requested relief under 2255. In the alternative, it asked for a transfer of the request to the Southern District. Now, the Northern District came to the conclusion that its 2255 was untimely. The Northern District did not issue a final judgment in the matter. It did not finally resolve the merits of the question, whether he was entitled to relief. Instead,
it dismissed the 2255.
what the court said was the record was not clear to establish at that time that he was entitled to the requested post-conviction relief. He said that that same relief might be available under a different statute.
He denied the 2255. The
as
fact
untimely.
That he says the same, okay.
Yes, sir.
So I don't understand you're not appealing. Look, suppose you have a federal question case and it has a supplemental state claim. And suppose the district court says, well, I'm dismissing your federal case, I'm relinquishing jurisdiction over your supplemental claim to the state court. They're very parallel, you know, one is a 1983, the other is state tort law, and you may very well be able to establish your entitlement to relief under state law, but you don't have a 1983. Well, you have to appeal that. You can't go to the state court, lose, and then say, oh, well, you know, I thought I might get relief under state law. Now I want to appeal for my dismissal of my 1983.
Yes, sir, I agree completely. The difference in this situation was it was not a transfer from a federal court to a state court, right?
The point is, he's got two avenues of relief. He's got 2255 in the sentencing district, 2241 in the confinement district.
Yes, sir.
Right? That's two completely different places. And when he strikes out under 2255, that's the end of his 2255. He has another route, but that's the end of the 2255.
And Your Honor, there have been decisions by this circuit and other circuits that have consistently stated that when you file a request for habeas relief on several grounds, and the initial determination is transferred to a different federal court, you're still in federal court.
No, if the whole case is transferred, that's one thing. But this is two completely separate claims. We know they're separate. They have to be filed in different places.
Yes, sir.
And if one of them is out, you have to appeal. I mean, what if he'd filed a 2255 appeal in one district and his 2241 in another district? Well, then when his 2255 is denied, he couldn't say, well, I don't have to appeal that until I lose on 2241, right?
I understand.
So what difference does it make if instead of filing the two separate claims as he should have in two separate districts, he mistakenly files one of them in the wrong district? Why should that give him more time to appeal?
Your Honor, I think your concern is legitimate. We, however, also have the concern regarding piecemeal appeals. And should this court take the approach that you are required...
Look. You can't, by filing in the wrong place, delay your appeal from, you know, 30 days to 2 years or something. That doesn't make any sense. That's your argument.
Well, our argument, Your Honor, is that my client was proceeding pro se. He filed a request for relief that establishes his innocence. He filed it in the Northern District of Indiana under 2255, and that court did not render a final judgment on his relief. I mean, the facts of the two arguments are the same. The relief sought is the exact same.
So he had his 30 day to appeal to his 2255. Now, there are very limited, what is it, Rule 4 or something, appellate rules, they're very limited grounds for delaying your appeal beyond the 30 days. You know, go to the district court, and he has some period of time in which he can allow you to file a belay. So that's what the rules provide for people who don't file within the 30 days. Now, you're asking for some kind of new doctrine delaying appeals for years, because you've got a pro se makes a mistake. Why do we want to get? Is it courts have not? You know, we have tolling doctrines, But we don't have tolling doctrines for appeals.
Yes, sir, I understand. Respectfully, we're not asking for any departure from this court and other courts' traditional application of the merger rule. And that is, when you have an inter-circuit transfer order, you may appeal all non-moot interlocutory orders.
That's fine. If the thing is transferred, that's fine. But you've got two separate things. He merged them improperly.
Well,
he had no right to merge them. So all it could be transferred, he couldn't transfer the whole thing.
Your Honor, if that is true, if that is the interpretation, then petitioner should be able to request a final judgment in the Northern District, because that court has never issued a final determination in this case. We should be able to file a notice of appeal from that determination and consolidate it with this appeal, because the Northern District never gave us any final judgment from which we could have appealed. So we decided to defer, understandably so, under the assumption that the two, the interlocutory order would merge, and we could appeal from the final judgment.
Mr. Sauer, can you point to any case in which an appeal has been allowed in a similar posture, where the case was transferred and no appeal was filed until the resolution of the 2241?
Your Honor, I don't recall whether there is a specific case where you have filed a 2255 and you're asking for a review of the 2241. There have certainly been cases cited in our brief, in the 11th Circuit in particular, in several circuits, that have said when you file a request for habeas relief and one court determines in part that you are denied relief and transfers it to another district, you are entitled to wait and appeal. We have found no authority for the proposition that you're required to file a separate notice of appeal, because it would do nothing but encourage piecemeal appeals, which this court has a policy against.
Yeah, well, that is completely wrong, because the piecemeal appeal problem comes about because you have someone who files in the wrong place.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Punished, and it's made clear you can't do that, you're not going to have a piecemeal appeal problem.
Sure. Well, then the consequence of such an approach would be that there has not been a final judgment issued by the Northern District. We've had nothing from which to appeal.
You say there's been no... I think you're saying there's been no Rule 58 a separate judgment, right?
That's correct.
That's what you mean, yeah.
Unless Your Honors have any more questions, I see my white light is on. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
So, Mr. Rodker?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Michael Rodker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the respondent, Mark Beese.
Mr. Rodker, before you begin, there's a bottom line question that has been running around in my mind. If the Supreme Court upholds our holding in Santos,
yes,
is it the department's contention that Mr. Morales would have no avenue available to him to challenge his conviction, even though the Supreme Court decision would mean he was actually innocent?
Yes, Your Honor, it would, because the
we're going to fill our prisons with innocent.
No, Your Honor, certainly this is an extraordinary case. We're not denying that. The remedy, look, the circumstances are that the only way he can proceed to 2241 is by showing that 2255 was inadequate or ineffective. And whether he's relying on this court's decision in Shalaba or the Supreme Court's decision in Santos, he still has to overcome that threshold obstacle. Our position is, because the legal theory here could have been asserted not only in a 2255 that was timely filed, but because he could have asserted it at trial, on direct appeal, nothing precluded him from doing so, the statute is not inadequate or ineffective, and that's an insuperable obstacle to his entitlement to seek habeas relief. He can't pursue a second or successive 2255 because Santos will be a rule of statutory construction. And so the only remedy he would have is habeas, but in the circumstances here, that remedy wouldn't be open. And what the Supreme Court said in Herrera versus Collins is the remedy is executive clemency. Now, we don't take that position lightly, Your Honors, but it is a happenstance of the way this case has evolved and the particular circumstances that have evolved. He's not completely without remedy. He's without judicial remedy.
Now, you've acknowledged that because there's no Rule 58 order in the Northern District, he could go back, request the
yes.
order, and appeal and so
Absolutely.
On. So we have to face this again.
Well, regrettably, I guess so. I mean, to be candid with the court, I have no idea why they just didn't. Under malice, he's free to take an appeal today. He can go across to the clerk's office after the argument and file his notice of appeal. We pointed that out. We conceded the point that he's free to, what we believe is to invoke this court's jurisdiction in due course and not through this sort of tortured and, we believe, improper merger theory. But the petitioner hasn't done so. I can't speak for why that's the case, but we don't deny that he has that avenue open to him. It's just in the circumstances here, I think that we have an obligation to, point out that there's a jurisdictional shortcoming.
Let me just press you a bit on that.
Sure.
You know, we do say you can wait until the Rule 58.
Right.
But can you wait forever?
Well,
preposterous, right? I mean, suppose
I think that
your case is dismissed, the judge is through with it, you say, well, he didn't enter a Rule 58
right.
order, so I'm going to wait. Maybe in 10 years the law will change. I'll appeal.
The language from...
Has this ever been discussed,
no.
this problem of the strategic withholding of a request for Rule 58?
Your Honor's question presupposes it was strategic. I'm not in a position to speak to that, but I
just wondered if this issue had arisen.
No, I mean, the language that we cited in the footnote in our brief from this court's decision in In re Kilgus, it's something to the effect of a party is always free to wait until judgment day. You know, whether there's some kind of latches defense, yeah. that it's, at some point it becomes too long, theoretically, yeah. I mean, there may be some kind of defense if it's a strategic
some
withholding.
Some documents have been determined to qualify as Rule 58 orders, though, right? We weren't really intended that, but we've said...
Yeah, I believe that's right, Your Honor. But again, there's nothing here. We've acknowledged, look, he entered the order, the three-page order saying the 2255 is time-barred in the transfer, but that's obviously, I don't believe the order in and of itself is enough. I think you do need some kind of a separate piece of paper, as the court has said.
Pretty strange person that would want to sit in jail.
Well, that's I'm not in a position.
I think I'll sit here in jail.
It strikes me the belts and suspenders approach would have been to proceed under both courses, to file the notice of appeal from the 2255, let this court determine whether or not jurisdiction lies, and to proceed. But, the response that I want to make on the idea about that this position somehow fosters piecemeal appeals, it's quite to the contrary. I think that the interest of judicial efficiency promote the rule that he should have appealed directly, and the reason is you don't get to 2241 until the 2255 issues have been fully and finally determined. If it turns out that he has a remedy under 2255, then the entire 2241 becomes effectively advisory and unnecessary.
Of course, we also have to throw into this whole wonderful mix that the guy's got this ineffective lawyer who's saying, don't worry.
Well, I guess I'm glad Your Honor raised the question. I do want to make a couple of points on that. The notion that he's entitled to equitable tolling for the 38-plus months before he filed his motion after the time limit expired. The allegations that he has raised in our position, in our view, would demonstrate, if they're credited, they would demonstrate that that an extraordinary circumstance impaired his ability to timely file. That's a necessary condition for tolling, but it's not sufficient. He's also got to demonstrate reasonable diligence. That is a well-established principle by the Supreme Court and Seventh Circuit precedent. And our position is that there are two shortcomings as to the diligence component, either of which is independently enough to justify or affirm the dismissal without a hearing. The first is, as Your Honor, Judge Rovner's question suggested, we believe that the allegations that he made with respect to his diligence during the first year are too, they're not the kind of detailed and specific allegations about time, place, and manner that would justify a hearing. And this court has emphasized repeatedly a hearing is not a matter of right, it's a matter of discretion.
Well, I ask about the disciplinary proceeding. Certainly, if that was the basis
right.
for his voluntary withdrawal from the bar, wouldn't there be some record of that?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, I don't know for a fact, but, our position is that we don't need a hearing to resolve these issues because the allegations with respect to diligence during the first year, which is all he claims, that his lawyer misled him during the time when he should have filed, those allegations are not specific and detailed enough to trigger a hearing. But the equally fundamental defect is the pink elephant in the room, if you will, There's no allegations as to the 38-month delay. A reasonably diligent individual who's professing his innocence and who's claiming that he's been wrongly convicted, certainly there should be some obligation to come forward on his part to safeguard his own rights.
The timing of the disciplinary action, too, makes a difference, because if that occurred later,
correct,
it may show... I'm not sure exactly what it is.
It would provide an additional arrow in our quiver. But again, I think here the critical fact to know is that the allegations regarding Kinney's actions, Morales himself specifically states that that's during the first year. He doesn't purport to claim that there was some ongoing deception during the 38 months. And if the requirement of reasonable diligence means anything, it can't be that equitable tolling of an extraordinary duration of 38 months here could be justified. And that's why we don't think he's met a prima facie case for a hearing, let alone for tolling.
But why not a hearing when you have such a strange mix of things happening? The real possibility that you will have an innocent person languishing.
I appreciate that concern, Your Honor, but I think some responsibility has to fall on the petitioner. He's the one that has to come forward. He's the one that has to explain the extraordinary delay. Look, the claim that he wanted to raise, proceeds means profits, it's been available since the day the indictment was returned in 1996. Okay? He could have raised it at trial. He could have raised it in direct appeal. He could have raised it in a cert petition. And he could have raised it for 1 year after his conviction became final.
But
he waited 38 months.
He had this terrible, ineffective lawyer.
At the tail end. That still doesn't justify his failure to raise it at trial and on direct appeal.
Well, he had the same person all along. Heaven only knows what this guy was doing.
Look, I understand the court's question, and I appreciate it, but first of all, there's no jurisdiction as the threshold impediment. But even if that weren't here, we just don't think that the allegations here, what he's asking for a tolling of the limitations period with no accountability and no diligence on his part, I think that's an extraordinary request, and he has to bear some burden for coming forward and justifying that.
Suppose the Supreme Court upholds Shalaba.
Yes.
And, rejects the other four circuits or whatever.
Yes.
So would he have any remedy at that point?
I don't think so because there's two. I mean, assuming this court decides this case as it is, he could file another 2241 because there's no AEDPA bar to a second or successive 2241s. But I believe... Let me qualify and temper my answer to what I said to Judge Rovner. He still has to show it's inadequate or ineffective. Now, I suppose...
I'm sorry, show what is inadequate?
He still could have raised it under 2255, so he can't get to 2241 under Davenport. I mean, he still has to show that it's inadequate or ineffective.
I see.
I mean, I guess...
You're saying...
It still wouldn't fly.
He could have raised... If he had raised it in 2255, lost because of Shalaba...
That'd be different.
And the Supreme Court rejected...
Right. That'd be different.
That's what you're saying.
He doesn't have to get through the savings clause. But I guess to temper my answer to Judge Rovner, I'm not in a position to take a definitive stance, and I don't know the answer to it, but at least theoretically, I suppose if the Supreme Court agreed with this court in Santos with the interpretation... I suppose the government might have discretion to waive the savings clause, inadequate or ineffective, and allow him. I don't know. I mean, I'm just hypothesizing here.
Yeah.
It's certainly something that we could consider, but I think as a strict doctrinal matter, we would be correct in defending the integrity of it and saying he still can't pass through the savings clause. So just to qualify my answer, I don't want to take a position. It's not something I thought about, and I would probably have to get others to sign off on that view. But at least it's something that would have to be explored, I would think.
And this is probably an unfair question, but how often... Are you aware of how often executive clemency is granted?
No. It's rare. I mean, there may have been cases after McNally or these types of statutory cutbacks where it's happened. I mean, it's certainly viable, and the Supreme Court in Herrera said it's a theoretical option. If the court has no further questions on the 2255, I just want to make a couple of points on 2241. As I alluded to earlier, the position is that... the statute's not inadequate or ineffective because he could have raised it earlier. The one point that I want to make clear is the position that seems to have been articulated is that he couldn't have raised it at trial or on direct appeal because Shalaba wasn't decided until 2 months after the limitations period expired. And so he's claiming that because the decision couldn't have been, wasn't on the books, if you will, he couldn't have asserted the claim. Two disagreements with that. First of all, as the court knows, the test under Davenport and as the court restated in Taylor versus Gilkey is whether the legal theory was available. the theory being proceeds as profits. It's not whether there's a decision on the books endorsing the theory. It's whether the theory was out there for the taking. And certainly the theory was. There was no precedent foreclosing that claim. And in fact, although we don't think that you need a judicial decision endorsing the theory, I just want to emphasize to the court that in 1991, 5 years before the indictment, this court in the Masters case adopted a proceeds as profits theory under the RICO forfeiture statute. And look, Mr. Shalhava himself made the argument. Somebody could have made the argument. It was a statutory construction claim. It's out there for the taking. As the court said in Shalhava, it's a question of first impression. Anybody could have made the argument. Mr. Shalhava did. Why couldn't Mr. Morales have made the argument? You don't need a judicial decision.
This relates to your argument about the adequacy of 2255?
That it's not inadequate because the theory was available. You don't need a decision endorsing the theory. The last point that I just want to make on this front.
What would it mean for a theory to be available? Would a theory be unavailable if, I guess,
foreclosed?
It could be foreclosed by a decision, even though a decision could always be overruled.
And that's precisely the point that I wanted to get to. That's the distinction between the scenario in Davenport and Privat and the situation we have here. Because in those situations, you were dealing with a situation where circuit law foreclosed the claim, the legal theory. The theory about what use meant was foreclosed by circuit law in Mr. Nichols' case, who was the second defendant in Davenport. The theory about the reach of the federal arson statute in the Privat case was foreclosed by this court's decision in Stilwell. And so what those defendants did is they went ahead and they went to trial and direct appeal in their first 2255 because that theory wasn't available. Now, we know later that in the Bailey and the Jones cases, the Supreme Court cut back on the reach of the statute.
It's a little strange because a circuit can't foreclose an issue, right?
No, but as a matter of governing, you can foreclose it from the standpoint of district court discretion. I mean, there's in-bank reconsideration, obviously, is always available. But what this court said in Davenport is, and the key, I think, is that pre-Bailey precedents foreclosed.
So you accept that?
I accept that is the critical principle that I think distinguishes.
The Justice Department accepts that principle.
Principle being circuit law foreclosure? Yes. I mean, that's exactly what the court said in Davenport. But the key that distinguishes those cases from what we have here is there was nothing that prevented that theory. And as I alluded to earlier, if anything, the extant case law, the Masters decision, supported the theory. And that's the critical distinction. So in the Davenport and in the Privat situation, you did have a decision that made the theory available, but it's not that you needed the decision to make it available. It's that you needed the decision to overturn the circuit's erroneous interpretation that previously existed. And I think it would be an astounding expansion of those cases to say, well, you know, you need to have a decision in every respect, because then it gives litigants no incentive to pursue the claim. And that's, you know, we want people to be able to press these claims and not rely on the Mr. Shalhavas of the world to do their legwork for them. And so for all these reasons, we think that the court should simply affirm on the ground the statute wasn't inadequate or ineffective. It doesn't have jurisdiction over the 2255, but if by some happenstance they do happen to file a notice of appeal, we would still say that he's not entitled to a hearing because he hasn't met his burden, and we would ask the court to affirm. On the question of actual innocence, just as long as I have a few seconds left, we don't think that you need to reach it to decide the issue of whether a circuit court decision is enough, particularly in light of the grant in Santos. If the court is inclined to reach that issue, if I may just complete my sentence, we agree with the court's considered statements in Davenport that when you have a circuit split, it's not enough to make the defendant actually innocent, because there's no basis for saying one circuit's right and one circuit is wrong. So if the court wants to reach that question, we would endorse the Davenport view.
Did he, in his activity for this gambling enterprise, did he violate any other crimes, state or federal?
Yeah, there were other federal, I don't know about state. There may have been state law violations. There were other federal charges that were against him, but they were dismissed as part of the plea agreement, and none of them were, for Boosley purposes, they were neither more serious or as serious.
They were not as serious.
No, we have a footnote in our brief that lays that out. They were less serious from the standpoint of the statutory maximum.
Yeah, so okay. He probably would have served whatever time.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, it's hard to know because we don't know what charges he would have been convicted of, what the sentence and the guidelines range is, so it's difficult to speculate, but we acknowledge that the crimes were not as serious under Lewis versus Peterson, this court's decision.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rotker. Mr. Sauer, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Your
Your Honors, if I may just briefly respond to a couple.
So when are you going to file your, when are you going to ask for the Rule 58 to file a notice of appeal?
Judge Posner, we think we have reasonably relied on the Supreme Court's language about finality in habeas petitions.
If you look
at Andrews versus United States, it says, well, if I'm not going to persuade Your Honor, we will be happy to file a notice of appeal from
but
the district.
But he already told you what. What will that do for you?
We will be happy to do that. Now, that's what I want to get to second. And, you know, counsel uses the word astonishing. I mean, I'll use the word astonishing, too. It is astonishing to think that the government could concede a man's actual innocence under this circuit's law, yet say he is entitled to no relief whatsoever.
Actual innocence under this circuit's law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear you.
Supreme Court is, you know, is going to decide what this statute means, right?
That's exactly right. And this court has taken the approach.
You have to be actually guilty, right?
That's certainly true. Yet his co-defendants have had the benefit of this circuit law. You have continued to apply the circuit law despite the cert grant in Santos. And we would request you to do the same thing.
He's actually innocent.
Well, to us, yes, Your Honor, it does. I don't understand why he's not innocent.
He's actually innocent today, and then when the Supreme Court reverses, you know, throws out Shalaba, he's actually guilty?
Yeah, of course. And the government will be, able to seek the benefit of any adverse decision in the Supreme Court. I mean, the point is that...
You get him put back in?
The point is, well, I'm...
You get him out, and then he gets put back in after the Supreme Court rules?
That I'm sure, would be the position the government would take on appeal.
Yes.
That, I mean, this government is continuing to incarcerate...
Can you envisage a situation which 2255 is granted and he's released? And then, because he's actually innocent, then the Supreme Court reverses Shalaba, and then the government puts him back in?
I have no doubt that the I have no doubt that the cases that I've seen from the Supreme Court on the issue suggest that the government does have the right, because it is an appeal from an adverse habeas decision, to bring them back.
Of course, the Supreme Court could say it's not retroactive. Their decision is not retroactive.
Well, Your Honor, if I see that I've run out of time, if I may finish and answer your question, the Supreme Court has followed a rule that issues of substantive statutory interpretation are necessarily retroactive, so that wouldn't be necessary.
But suppose we held that he was actually innocent and ordered him released, and suppose the government didn't appeal, didn't ask for cert, and then eventually the Supreme Court threw out Shalaba.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get him back into prison.
I agree.
So that's your strange argument. He's actually innocent now. The Supreme Court in a few months may determine that he's actually guilty. But then it would be too late, right?
Yeah, Your Honor.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
I think you, this court in Malone established that the court would continue to apply its interpretation of Scalaba. It vacated someone's conviction based on this exact substantive argument and remanded to the district court.
The reason that we haven't revisited Shalaba is that once you have a circuit conflict, you don't really do anything I could have eliminated. But once the Supreme Court has granted cert, there's no reason for a court to reexamine its decision. So the fact that we're not going to overrule Shalaba now doesn't mean that we think it's correctly decided.
Well, I agree with that. I cite that case only for the proposition that the court has established a precedent where it will continue to apply its law until instructed otherwise. 10 months away, 9-10 months. This case won't be heard until the October term, decided in February or March. And we think that delay would be unreasonable. We think in that span of time we should be entitled to a hearing. He's alleged facts, egregious facts, that every circuit that has addressed this issue has found sufficient to give rise to equitable tolling.
How much of his sentence is served?
He has been incarcerated since February of 1999, so he has served 8 years. And the other two charges are illegal gambling charges, which I'm surprised the government doesn't concede. Under the sentencing guidelines at that time, he has certainly served his time. The statutory max would be 5 years. Even if he were convicted of both offenses, with his lack of criminal history, he's serving for conduct that is not a crime right
there
now.
There were only two other co-defendants, and they are both free.
They have both been free for over 2 years, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chang. You were requested to represent Morales, and we thank you for your efforts on
Your Honor.
His behalf, and thank you, Mr. Rodker. So.